It is my great honor to introduce to you Dr. Revero P. Oliver of Urbana, Illinois.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. I believe I've had no higher honor than the successive invitations that have been given me to speak before this great body. I am proud and proud indeed to appear before the Congress of Freedom. Ladies and gentlemen, you may have heard the story of the young Hindu prince who came from one of the better families in India. A good deal of the Aryan stock left. He was the son of a Maharaja. He was sent to Oxford for his education, as is so commonly done. While at Oxford, he met an English girl, and he saw more and more of her, found her more and more attractive. So finally, he decided that he would propose. So he looked at her and he said, "Your hair is like spun gold. Your brow is of ivory. Your eyes are like stars. Your lips are like rubies. Your teeth are like pearls. All my life I've dreamed of meeting 10 or 20 girls like you." Well, if the story has a point, it is simply this, that of all the illusions that our unhappy civilization has conceived, the worst, I think, is the illusion that there can possibly be a one world. The profound differences that separate large parts of humanity from other parts of humanity, that are certainly biological and racial, cultural and religious, are so deep that it is entirely possible that two minds from widely differing groups cannot ever understand one another. I was scheduled to speak on the communist penetration of Latin America, which would, of course, be an interesting subject at this time, particularly in view of the recent developments of Brazil, which follow pretty much what has been predicted for years in the scoreboards of American opinion, and the really shocking events in Panama, most of which were kept from the knowledge of the American people by some strange mechanism that seems to control our news services. I have been asked, however, specifically to discuss with you the recent campaign against me in the press and over the radio. Not that there would be any interest in my own personal experiences, but since they may be instructive as typical specimens of the forces with which we are confronted in this country. As most of you know, in the February issue of American Opinion, I very rudely jabbed a pen into a particularly sensitive boil on our enfevered and infected body politic. What came out was precisely what was to be expected. Now, it should, of course, be understood that there was nothing novel or remarkable in the concerted personal attack on me that was launched about 2 weeks after the publication of the February issue. Such massive mudslinging operations have been mere routine since the international communist conspiracy acquired a firm base and effective power in our federal government. That fact was most succinctly stated, I believe, by the editors of National Review in the issue of that periodical, dated April 19, 1958, in which they say, "It is an established law of our epoch that any individual who begins to get public attention for ideas that run firmly and specifically counter to Soviet policy objectives will become the target for a massive campaign of defamation that will go on until he is politically and often physically silent. Such campaigns originate in the secret chambers of the communist apparatus and are commonly triggered by the words of an open or concealed communist agent. They are carried on for the most part, however, not by the communists themselves, but by the massive exertions of the slavish liberal left. In our own nation, as in all nations, the honor roll of victims is long and varied. Charles Lindbergh, Pat McCarran, Jan Valton, Robert Fogler, William C. Bullitt, Joseph McCarthy, Louis Boudens, Arthur Coleman, George Stratemeyer, Whitaker Chambers, Martin Dies, Douglas MacArthur, William Jenner, and 101 others." Now, although National Review soon experienced some severe financial crises and now finds it expedient to deprecate what it calls the conspiratorial theory, its editors in 1958 stated an obvious truism. Systematic defamation has always been standard procedure for our domestic rodents. Before Franklin Roosevelt was lodged in the White House, the conspiracy carried on such operations under superficially plausible disguises. But for the past 30 years, no attentive observer can have been in doubt concerning either the instigation or the methods of such campaigns. Now, it was not a fortuitous discovery, much less a triumph of analytic insight, that exposed that operational procedure of the Bolsheviks. It was a strategic decision necessarily made by their high command. In September 1933, a number of traitors established in several departments of the federal government foregathered with a known and paid Soviet agent on a social occasion at which Dr. William A. Wirt, superintendent of schools in Gary, Indiana, was also present. The criminals probably assumed that, given the conspiracy's deep penetration of American colleges, and especially of colleges of education, over the preceding 20 and 25 years, a successful professional educator, if not himself an enlisted member of the conspiracy, would be either a conscious racketeer who would understand how much it was to his own interest to collaborate with them, or a dunderhead who couldn't tell the difference between his own country and the rest of the world. At all events, the termites were so indiscreet as to allude to their plans for capturing the United States and to boast in the presence of Dr. Wirt that Franklin Roosevelt was the American counterpart of Kerensky, the ambiguous Russian socialist, who was a knowing or unwitting tool of the Bolsheviks and prepared the way for the capture of Russia by Lenin, Trotsky, and their associated degenerates in 1917. Dr. Wirt, who was a loyal and conscientious American, recognized the duty that is incumbent on all Americans, and he therefore testified before a committee of Congress. Communist agents are not supermen. Like ordinary bandits and murderers, they make mistakes all the time. And it was doubtless a mere blunder which led the creatures to expose themselves in the presence of Dr. Wirt. But the situation thus accidentally created called for a policy decision on the highest level. It would have been very simple and easy to have the heads of the government departments involved simulate shocked astonishment and to retire the blubbermouth conspirators from the public payroll, at least for a few years, retire them to the sanctuary of universities, foundations for the advancement of learning, and other convenient hideouts. The directors of the international conspiracy, however, must have rejected that facile solution, judging that the time had come for a little open terrorism. A simple signal brought the rats swarming from the sewers of society. Liberal intellectuals, actuated always by a conscious or subconscious awareness of their own inferiority, gladly joined the pack, and unlimited funds were available from the United States Treasury and other sources to hire such more intelligent accomplices as were needed. By this concerted effort, the international criminals succeeded in breaking Dr. Wirt and procuring his death in 1938. The attack on Dr. Wirt was one of the many mentioned by former Congressman Dyes in his excellent article in the February issue of American Opinion, in which he speaks of, quote, thousands other such cases of vilification, end quote, that he does not list for lack of space. These were all carried out by the conspiracy with a nice calculation. Although they undoubtedly share Harry Hopkins' opinion that Americans are just too damn dumb to understand what is being done to them, our enemies rely on their working control of communications to prevent the general public from perceiving the monotonous pattern in all their campaigns of defamation, and thus coming for itself to the conclusion that the spitting squads are mere Bolshevik instrumentalities. But on the other hand, great care is taken to make that fact obvious to every observer who has studied the methods of the conspiracy. When the vermin conduct such campaigns to destroy their active opponents, they have a second and even more important objective: to terrorize potential opponents. By destroying Dr. Wirt, they in effect proclaimed loudly and emphatically to everyone who knew enough to recognize communist methods, "See how we can manipulate the American boobs for their own destruction? See what happens to Americans who do not keep their mouths shut when they see us taking over their country?" Well, now, since that time, no American who has learned to recognize the animals can have been in any doubt about the consequences of annoying skunks and communists. The nasty little creatures undoubtedly have means of making themselves respected. The conspiracy's policy of terrorism has been very effective. Many Americans who know what is happening to the United States are understandably afraid of what will happen to them personally if they publicly oppose treason and invasion. Others seek a relatively safe compromise by opposing, on general, economic, social, or religious grounds, certain communist-inspired policies without naming the conspiracy. And although such opposition does make a real contribution to the American cause, it is safe at the present time and for the time. It is safe because the criminals are delighted when their murderous lusts are described as intellectual errors. But what the editors of National Review aptly termed an established law of our epoch has another aspect. It provides Americans with a very useful standard of measurement, a very simple formula. The effectiveness of any anti-communist and patriotic organization is directly proportional to the amount of venom poured on it by the communist and crypto-communist press and radio. Although the vermin are wise enough occasionally to stage perfunctory attacks on groups that they really wish to encourage as nugatory or diversionary operations, you may be quite sure that their most vicious and sustained attacks are directed against the American organizations they most fear. You may trust the enemies of mankind to identify and evaluate the forces that stand between them and completion of their conquest of the world. I need scarcely say that I myself personally was the most unimportant item in such an attack. Now, since the conspiracy's techniques are comparatively simple and uniform, I shall draw a few illustrations from my own experience, which was barely typical, and for which I have most of the record at hand. The conspiracy, as distinct from a few enthusiastic individuals, ignored me until the spring of 1959. In January of that year, by methods duplicating in all essentials the methods that had been used in China and other countries, the international vermin captured Cuba. It was, of course, perfectly obvious to anyone who had observed Latin American affairs or took the trouble to consult the record that Fidel Castro and his principal accomplices were veteran communist agents. It was furthermore a matter of public record. Communist conquest of Cuba had been made possible by the active cooperation of our State Department. It necessarily followed that Cuba, like China, had been delivered to our enemies by traitors in Washington. It required no ingenuity whatever to see that the conspiracy wanted Cuba as a base for submarines and ballistic missiles with which to threaten the United States. And that obvious deduction was quickly confirmed by reliable reports from Cuba that Soviet technicians had begun the construction of such bases a few weeks after Castro came to power. A slight knowledge of military engineering and conditions in Cuba sufficed to yield an estimate that it would take approximately 2 years to make that island an effective military threat to the United States. That is to say, one that would permit our domestic vermin to change their tune and start squeaking that a nuclear war would be unthinkable. As other Americans at that time, I pointed out those simple facts in public lectures, including one that I gave in February, and of which, greater part of which, I had the honor of repeating before this distinguished organization the following April. The conspiracy naturally was trying to conceal the treason in Washington by filling the daily and weekly live papers with the usual hogwash about agrarian reform, the underprivileged, democratic ideals, and the other verbal refuse whose odor never fails to excite liberal intellectuals. I predicted that that deluge of slop in the press and radio would continue until the Soviet bases in Cuba were completed, and the time had come for Washington again to disgrace the United States by admitting at last that the communist colony was a communist colony, and then proclaiming to the world that Americans were too craven and cowardly to destroy that colony in their own self-defense. Now, in 1959, a spitting campaign in the press on a national scale would have had the disadvantage of calling attention to the very facts that the traitors were trying to conceal. This appears to have created some little perplexity at first, and when the campaign against me finally got underway, it took the form of letters to the University of Illinois from its sincere well-wishers, who deplored the presence on its faculty of a vile fascist whose mind was so diseased that he could imagine that the George Washington of Cuba could be sympathetic to the communists. The press was used only locally to counter to counteract the effect of speeches that I made. The more honest newspapers that felt obliged to yield to subversive pressures did no more than fail to report what I had said, or to report only the most trivial details. The really infected press, however, did much better. The prize should be awarded, I think, to a carpetbagger sheet in a southern city which reported that I did not exist. They said that no one of my name was to be found on the faculty of any American university, that I had been recognized as an unsuccessful actor on Broadway, and that they had found out that local reactionaries had paid me $2,000 to impersonate a university professor and traduce the pure-hearted Fidel. My only objection was that they never sent the check. There were, of course, various kinds of indirect pressures. I've never had any difficulty with intellectually respectable colleagues, but some of the others were at pains to let it be known that professors of the classics got no business knowing anything about anything that happened after, after whenever it was that the Roman Empire fell. One who came around to threaten me, however, relied on a neat demonstration, somewhat in the matter of Euclid, that I think worth repeating. He had 5 points. 1, a scholar must speak only about matters on which he is an authority. 2, the only authorities on communism are communists, since only they can know what it's all about. 3, all communists say it's just fine. 4, as for ex-communists, well, they obviously left the party after a tiff with their superiors, so they bear a grudge, and so they can't be believed under oath about anything. So, 5, it ain't ethical or scholarly for me to criticize communists. QED. The agitation rid me of a few feigned friends, worried some real ones. It was, however, somewhat difficult to resist the sincere suasion of those who urged, and quite sincerely, that I would be more effective if I covered what I had to say with treacle. I was told that it was untimely to utter more than a few cautious hints about Castro while the kept press was so loudly singing hosannas, and to call Lenin and Trotsky vermin was needlessly to pain fastidious minds by reminding them of the existence of mice and even more horrid things. Well, I do not know how effective circumspect insinuations and delicate circumlocutions may be over the precious teacups of our select salon, but I always felt that they ill accord with the temper of the American people. I've always thought that the best way to describe a skunk was to call him a skunk. Well, the attacks on me ceased abruptly on the very day on which the George Washington of Cuba, perhaps a little impulsively and prematurely, boasted that he had been a Bolshevik from adolescence. It was doubtless felt that further attacks at that time might tactlessly remind the public of the hundreds of university professors throughout the country who, like the late Lee Harvey Oswald, served the Conspiracy in Fair Play for Cuba committees and industriously produced smokescreens to cover Comrade Castro. Now, let me point out that the current communist line directed against all American conservatives is the one that, as General Watts reminded you a little while ago, the one that was ordered by the conspiracy from its Russian headquarters on the 5th of December, 1960. If you want a conspectus of those orders and an expert analysis of them by Edward Hunter, a real student of communist methods of brainwashing, see the pamphlet, The New Drive Against the Anti-Communist Program, issued by the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security in 1961. The basic communist line was set forth in a little booklet published by one of the official communist publishers, The Fascist Revival. It's obtainable in any communist bookstore for 35 cents. It was written under the alias of Mike Newberry by a columnist for The Worker, whose real name, according to Commander Winston, is Sammy Steiner. Sammy, who is believed to operate under several aliases, is also one of the pink-eyed creeps whose activities are discussed by Counterattack in the issue dated March 27, 1964. You know, Counterattack is a fortnightly newsletter compiled and edited by former members of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and I particularly recommend that issue of March 27th as containing one of the most concise and lucid analyses of the superficially disguised operations that are perhaps the greatest single source of Bolshevik influence over the United States today. Now, it's really unfortunate that almost no Americans, other than students of the international conspiracy, read The Worker and other official publications of our domestic enemies. If they did, they could examine from a week to a quarter in advance the slime about radical right, right-wing extremists, fascists, racists, Nazis, and so on, that the crypto-communists and their cheap hirelings insert daily in the daily, weekly, and fortnightly lie papers throughout the country. I've always thought that if you want that kind of slime, get it pure from the source, undiluted, and in advance. So raid The Worker. I insist on that point because there's a ready and simple means of identification available to everyone. If you're in doubt about a publication's real purposes, just leaf through the files and note the correspondence between what it tried to make its readers believe at a given time and the official communist objectives as disclosed by what they achieved later. Now, to be sure, a local paper can be held strictly accountable only for editorials and other material that it originates, not for the stuff supplied by the national wire services and syndicates, much of which the editor, if uninformed and gullible, may publish in good faith. We must also remember that most publications are subject to pressure from their advertisers, and that the conspiracy may control, directly or indirectly, vast accumulations of capital. Americans who read financial news have long been accustomed to such displays of financial genius as that which exhibited by one David Kotz, alias David Carr, who, according to the report published in Counterattack, this newsletter that I have cited, on the 28th of April, 1961, began his career as a wretched penny a liner for the Daily Worker and other official communist filth sheets, but like a rocket propelled by some mysterious fuel, quickly soared aloft to the position of president of the Fairbanks Whitney Corporation, which had formerly been called Penn Texas, a holding company which controlled 12 of our largest industrial concerns, including some that were noted for conservative and even staunchly American policies before their original owners lost control. I have been unable to obtain from any source even a rough estimate of the amount of advertising purchased in newspapers and on the radio by those corporations and their numerous subsidiaries, to say nothing of the many others that are or may be under similar direction. But it's only fair to note that the publishers of many newspapers, despite good intentions, may be forced to shameful compromises at least to the extent of not printing what they would otherwise disclose, just to remain solvent. That situation will continue until we Americans learn to discriminate between American and anti-American publications. And above all, until we learn to identify the advertisers who, maliciously or fecklessly, keep the latter in business. When we do that, we will at last be able to recapture our press. I was just shown this morning a copy of what appears to be an excellent weekly paper published here called the Birmingham Independent. It is a weekly. What I have never been able to understand about the South, which I love deeply, is why it has tolerated a carpetbagger press. I have hopes that this little weekly, The Independent, in Birmingham, will soon replace at least one of your dailies. I think it a matter of some little interest. The current attack on me seems not to have been launched without mature deliberation. It was not until 12 days after the February issue of American Opinion came from the press that the conspiracy pushed the button and set its slime machine to squirting from its 1,000 nozzles throughout the country. Now, the directors of the conspiracy are not infrequently confronted by the tactical problem of what to do about these nasty Americans. Although their machine can flood the country with its sewage, and once started will go on pumping until it's turned off at headquarters, such national efforts have the disadvantage that they may advertise what would otherwise pass unnoticed. The choice between silence and slime must often be a difficult one for the technicians. We've recently seen a perfect example of the use of silence as a tactical device. So long as Mr. Robert Welch's brilliant and irrefragable analysis of Eisenhower's career remained a private document, the conspiracy's smear artists, who had obtained a copy by theft or bribery, were forever quoting or misquoting a sentence or two from it and gabbling about the enormities which they claimed were to be found in the unpublished text. But when The Politician was published in March 1963, there was a sudden and unanimous silence. From the New York Times to the sleazy little communist fronting weeklies that mysteriously flourish in tiny towns, at least in the Middle West, from Time to obscure cult sheets for semi-literate barbarians, the whole of the liberal press meticulously avoided all mention of the book. It was as though a blaring radio had been turned off. To ears accustomed to the din, the instantaneous quiet was startling and revealing. Undoubtedly, the conspiracy strategists decided that even the most vituperative attack on the book would inform the American public that the text of The Politician was at last available to everyone. They resorted, therefore, to the old technique that had worked so well with important books in the past. Silence in the press, plus surreptitious pressures on bookstores throughout the nation to prevent them from stocking the book, if they heard of it, or even ordering copies for customers who had heard of it and wanted to buy it. The results, of course, were disappointing to the strategists. The first edition of The Politician was quickly sold out, despite the comparatively high price, and it is now available at only $2 per copy from the author, who has published it himself privately, you know, Mr. Robert Welch. When I last heard, over 50,000 copies had been sold, and the demand was steadily increasing. But had the international criminals ordered an all-out attack in the controlled press, it is possible that there might now be in circulation 500,000 copies of an irrefutable record that cannot have failed to awaken even the most somnolent American. Although the directors of the conspiracy may seem to have done the best that they could in the circumstances, they did make, I think, a grave tactical error. They sacrificed one of their most valuable assets by exposing, to all who will see, the extent of their control over our public communications. It was once possible to believe that our liberal editors and commentators were somehow independent of one another. Independent, at least, in the sense in which the frogs in a pond, though governed by the same instincts, are independent organisms, since sometimes one or two will croak and the rest remain silent, although, of course, they'll generally join the chorus. Now, if the denizens of our journalistic frog pond were free to behave with the Batrachian spontaneity, the politician would certainly have set some of them, doubtless many of them, to croaking loudly. The universal and unbroken silence was conclusive proof that all the liberal editors and commentators restrained their own instincts in disciplined obedience to orders that must have come from a single source. Even more significant, perhaps, was the behavior of the segments of the press and radio that have not yet been captured by liberals. Many sincere and intelligent editors who take the American side on national issues will privately confess that they did not dare to break the imposed silence concerning Mr. Welch's book, lest they bring upon themselves ruthless and ruinous reprisals. In short, the conspiracy was so afraid of this book, The Politician, that it gave us an indubitable and terrifying demonstration of the extent of its control over all the channels of public information and communication. And in the long run, that may prove to have been a costly mistake. Now, although my article on the assassination of Kennedy was certainly a very minor contribution to the American cause, it seems clear that the conspiracy's commanders took time to ponder the tactical choice between silence and slander. Their decision, so far as the results can be estimated at the present time, was another tactical blunder. They have thus far succeeded only in increasing the circulation of American opinion and in having the two-part article read by many, many thousands of Americans. Many thousands who would not otherwise have heard of it. Now, I think the decision was probably made on the basis of four distinct, though complementary, considerations. First, the article really was particularly obnoxious to the vermin because it served to break the hypnosis that had been induced in a large part of the American public by propagating the strange notion that the decease of Kennedy somehow made it wicked to remember what he had done while alive. That hypnosis, of course, was the major gain that the conspiracy had reaped from the assassination, since their even more important strategic objective, the liquidation of all American anti-communist organizations by a combination of spontaneous violence and pseudo-legal persecution, that was lost when their agent Oswald was apprehended and identified. I might mention that a great American, whom I regard as one of the best minds of our time, suggests that the conspiracy somehow obtained knowledge of a part of the article, which, since the whole was too long for inclusion in the February issue, was not published until March. He believes that the second part was even more damaging to the conspiracy than the first, and that the slime machine, therefore, may have been turned on in the hope of preventing the publication of the second part. That, of course, is possible. There were several ways in which the conspiracy could have learned in February what was to be published in March. For one thing, as we now know, from the disclosures made by Senator John Williams, which were corroborated by other evidence reported by Senator Edward V. Long, the gangsters who rule us use our taxes to hire blackguards to violate federal and state laws by tampering with the mails and tapping the telephones of private citizens and even members of Congress. For the second point, I think I may, without immodesty, suggest that my name was probably on a list of Americans to be given further attention at the first convenient opportunity. It was probably assumed that as a university professor, I would be particularly vulnerable to character assassination by experts at this time, since they could excite massive hysteria among the boobs who had been manipulated by the shameless techniques that were partly described by Sister Mary Paul Pay in her article, The Kennedy Cult, in United States News and World Report for September 10, 1962. Third, of course, one tactic that the conspiracy is using now in a desperate attempt to destroy the John Birch Society is that of smear campaigns to intimidate some members of the council. For this purpose, intensive local campaigns are usually preferred. Months ago in St. Louis, the malodorous Post-Dispatch, abetted by a few insignificant sheets elsewhere in Missouri, began a vicious attack on Mr. F. Gano Chance of Centralia, Missouri, a prominent manufacturer and an eminent patriot. And I believe they're still shrieking. If space permitted, it would be interesting to analyze this campaign in the light of inside information provided by a former member of the Post-Dispatch's staff concerning the sources of its animus against Americans. And fourth and last, I think we should note that the conspiracy is now striking almost frantically at its opponents by all possible means, including violence. In Scranton, Pennsylvania, for example, clamor about my article was used to incite a mob of young punks from the local diploma mill to besiege a hotel in which a representative of the society was addressing a small invited audience. And it required the best efforts of the local police, including officers summoned from their beds in such haste that they had time only to throw a coat over their pajamas, to keep the scum under control. That incident was part of a general policy that is not confined to the United States. I think it would be interesting to note that the same policy is being followed even more openly in the Dominion of Canada. In Canada, Mr. Eric D. Butler, the distinguished Australian authority on communism, editor of the New Times, that is published in Melbourne, and also editor of the Quarterly Intelligence Digest, is now on a tour speaking before Canadian audiences. The controlled press and radio in Canada, of course, has been shrieking with frequent use of the epithets of hate monger and Nazi that are the distinctive cries of the Red Vultures. In Edmonton, where hotel managers had been frightened into canceling long-standing contracts, riffraff in the employ of the Canadian Broadcasting Commission tried to force their way into the hall in which the meeting was held for the obvious purpose of disrupting the meeting. In Regina and Moose Jaw, both towns in Saskatchewan, bus loads of hoodlums led by university professors were rushed in to stage riots and were kept under control only by the firmness and vigilance of the police. In Moose Jaw, indeed, this rat pack either by predetermined plan or spontaneously indulging their diseased hatreds, attempted to rush the speaker's platform for no imaginable purpose other than that of trying to maim or kill Mr. Butler and his companion, who was Mr. Patrick Walsh, who was for many years the foremost expert on communism in the Canadian Mounted Police. Now, the conspiracy gained nothing from those efforts, for Mr. Butler, of course, is continuing his tour. It really defeated its own purpose, for the grotesque disorders showed many previously placid and easygoing Canadians what kind of creatures breed in the trash heaps that accumulate whenever a nation neglects its housekeeping. It may be worthy of noting briefly that the National Press Services were relatively cautious in their attack on me. And that was perhaps to be expected. After all, the vermin in Associated Press were really rash when they lied about that great American, General Walker, at the time that Kennedy's goons were terrorizing the citizens of Oxford, Mississippi. It may be, of course, that the smear artists felt confident that since General Walker had been kidnapped by lawless thugs and hustled to a concentration camp operated by imported sadists called mental health experts, he would be tortured to death or at least rendered helpless. But it didn't work out that way. Thanks partly to the very distinguished gentleman, general, and lawyer whom you heard an hour ago. But however the miscalculation was made, the Associated Press now faces suits for criminal libel, which I understand total $23 million. A modest sum in comparison to the offense, but sufficient to worry the offenders. Accordingly, United Press International, in its original dispatch, which I have seen, limited itself to relatively slight distortions. It said, for example, that I, quote, ridiculed the view held by the Federal Bureau of Investigation that Oswald was acting alone. Now, that was said, of course, in the hope that few readers would remember, and that as I pointed out in my article, the Illegal Warren Commission was keeping secret the report of the FBI. Now, it is true that shortly after Oswald was silenced by Rubenstein, the press, in an obvious attempt to pull communist chestnuts out of the fire, reported, as a supposed leak from the FBI, that report would show sometime in the future that Comrade Oswald was a loner. It did not report J. Edgar Hoover's categorical denial that any such leak had occurred. Now, Mr. Hoover was not drawn into disclosure of what the report actually contained, but it is a logical inference that he could not have been so positive in his denial of a leak had the report contained any such conclusion. And it is in any case highly improbable that his organization could have been so negligent or perverse as to overlook the evidence known even to the general public of Oswald's association with Rubenstein and his other conspiratorial activities. Somewhat more cunning was United Press International's statement that, quote, the Oliver article, don't expect to know much English, you know, the Oliver article said Oswald was arrested as a suspect in the shooting of former Major General Edward Walker, but was released, quote, through the personal intervention of Robert F. Kennedy, end quote. The article offered no confirmation of Oswald's arrest in the Walker shooting. Now, all that United Press's little genius twisted out of the passage on page 13 of my article, which begins with this explicit statement, according to a story that has been neither confirmed nor denied officially at the time that I write. And I then went on to mention that report. And in a footnote to that passage, I gave a reference to the publication, The Counselor, in which a reprint of that story was most generally available. While we're on that subject, it was the same in the same dispatch from United Press International that it was first reported that an unidentified spokesman for the Justice Department said that Oswald's, quote, possible involvement, end quote, in the attempt to murder General Walker, quote, did not come to the attention, end quote, of unidentified, quote, authorities until after the death of Kennedy. So far as I know, Bobby Sox himself has remained mum on this subject. I think these are worthy of note, because this is typical of the technique used by the more cautious sneaks in our press. The only attempt to question the accuracy of any statement of fact in my articles came much later and was ill-contrived. I had said that Earl Warren, and I quote myself, spends his vacations with little comrade Tito in Yugoslavia, or with big comrade Khrushchev in the Crimea, end quote. Well, quite belatedly, a faceless, quote, Supreme Court spokesman, presumably something like a janitor that all nine of them have got around as a convenience. Anyway, he was a spokesman. He carefully ignored the mention of Tito, but he told the Associated Press that, quote, Warren had not spent any vacations in Russia, end quote. Well, now that's a statement which could be technically true, since, as every schoolchild should know, the Crimea is part of the Ukraine, not of Russia proper. But not content to let well enough alone, the carefully anonymous spokesman went on to say that Warren, and I quote, had had no contact with Khrushchev, end quote. That was probably thought sufficient for another round of puking in the press. But in at least two cities, alert readers wrote their local papers and gave exact references to the issues in which the same papers had printed dispatches from the same Associated Press, reporting that Earl Warren, described as, quote, Chief Justice of the United States, end quote, was Khrushchev's guest on the latter summer estate. Well, now the editors did not print those letters for obvious reasons, but they doubtless cursed Americans who are so extremist as to remember what they read for more than a week or so. At all events, they deemed it expedient to shut up on that subject, and the coy spokesman from wherever he is in the basement of the Supreme Court building finally subsided into a mumbled claim that Earl hadn't vacationed, he had just visited. Now, the curious thing, it seems to me, is that the editors who howled about my article evidently thought it the most natural thing in the world that the person who now holds office as Chief Justice of a Supreme Court should have been out roistering with the world's vilest criminal and most bloody murderer. Now, of course, it may very well be natural for Earl and Nick to flock together. And quite probably they have many vital interests in common. But what is remarkable is that the association should be so open and notorious that it was reported even in our press. Nick's opinion of Americans was recorded in his famous aphorism, "When you spit in their faces, they think it's due." Earl presumably agrees. The National Wire Service has merely provided the occasion. President Pack, the real work of defamation, was entrusted to the editors of the various lie papers and the professional rabble-rousers of the radio and television. Thanks to the generous help of many Americans, I have been able to collect specimens of editorial pus from all parts of the country. The specimens show great variety in the jargon used and the form of hypocrisy that was thought most likely to deceive the local bourgeoisie, but there was an underlying uniformity. No one questioned or even mentioned the facts. No one disputed the logic of my deductions from those facts. All shrieked as loudly and as incoherently as a bevy of intoxicated banshees, shrieked in simulated horror at the very thought that an American swine should dare to criticize the defunct King John, who, as everyone should know, had become St. John the Beepist. There was something a little humorous about the campaign in some parts of the country. Several correspondents pointed out to me that what was really ludicrous was that the enraged homunculi accused me of disrespect to Massa Jack at the very time that they were frantically dragging the body of their dead hero as a red herring across the trail of the communist conspiracy. Only two aspects of the campaign seem to me to be worthy of notice. In many cities, Americans elicited from a howling editor a naive admission that he had never seen my article, much less read it. That, of course, proves nothing, for as we've long known, our liberals are so busy keeping their mouths open that they can't be expected to take time to find out what they are talking about. But as just one example out of many, I cite an editorial in the infrared Philadelphia Inquirer, a sheet that was long published by the famous old Mo Annenberg, a well-known financier and organizer of racetrack touts, who is said to have directed its editorial policy even from his cell back in the 40s, when internationalists were not yet exempt from American law. A hireling on the Inquirer's editorial staff produced a fairly good gob of mucus on the 19th of March, when they were simply jittering in fury that a vile American should be tolerated on the faculty of an American university. This little man called me, quote, the character assassin professor, unquote, who was guilty of blackguarding, our martyred president, end quote. So on ad nauseum. Now, I think the little fellow knew enough English to understand that his use of martyred implied that Kennedy, as the black Muslims have claimed, knew that he was going to be killed in Dallas, and so, in effect, committed suicide. But he probably assumed the readers of the Inquirer would not know what the word meant. He was, however, sufficiently ingenuous to confess to an American who asked him about that editorial, confessed that he had never read my article, and they really did not know what he was talking about. It was just a matter of editorial policy. In other words, his masters told him to spit, so he spat. Really very innocent. In fact, I'm sure that he was as innocently proud of his technical proficiency as was the artful Dodger whenever he brought two watches home to Papa Fagin, if you remember your Dickens. I hope that he was suitably rewarded. If the laborer is worthy of his hire, is not the pickpocket worthy of his cut, and the editorial writer worthy of a bonus? As an example of a somewhat franker approach, I cite a lie paper called The Advance Register, published in Tulare, California. It has long echoed the communist line about, quote, right-wing extremists, unquote. But my article evidently sent its chief puker into a connection fit. Crouching over his typewriter, he invented a five-line quotation from my article. I can scarcely say that nothing like that appears in the article itself. And then began screeching at the John Birch Society. How long, O Lord, how long must we stand idly by and let the hate peddlers attempt to cut the very heart guts out of America and the American way of life with words such as these? And he raved on for another column before coming to his peroration, which was this. The John Birch Society is a cancer gnawing away at the belly of America. It's about time steps were taken to rid the United States of this national curse, even if it does mean violation of the Constitution. End quote. Now, at that point, some elementary prudence restrained the bloodthirsty homunculus, and he did not more explicitly suggest that it was time for the comrades to get out their knives and start butchering the American livestock. I think on the whole that this has been a fairly instructive campaign in the press. I think that in several parts of the country, the furtive little vermin who squeak about hate mongers rashly gave to their perceptive readers a glimpse of the hatreds that fester under their misshapen skulls. They did us the service of helping Americans to learn what they need to know about their enemies.